From jet engines to space rockets, telephones to computers, the world has seen spectacular change in the last 100 years, and the pace of progress is getting faster and faster. From electric cars to the metaverse, drone deliveries to climate solutions and genetic sequencing, we're investing in the companies that are not just changing the world today, but are also shaping the future. The Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Invest in progress. Capital at risk.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Advice Show. From advice to practice management, this podcast gives you UK and global insights into the financial planning profession. I'm Nicola, Chief Reporter at Citywire New Model Advisor, and today I'm joined by Jeremy Gordon and Daniel Grote from Citywire, who over the past few weeks have published some exclusive Citywire research on the performance of the 10 biggest MPS providers. And they've come on the podcast today to tell us a bit more about what they found. So Jeremy and Dan, thanks so much for joining us. Dan, I'm going to start with you. I mean, what made you and Jeremy want to look into this research now? Some people in the industry have said they've never seen research like it. They've never seen like-for-like comparison of these providers and their performance before. So, yeah, what was the process like and what made you want to do it?
Well, I think it was really in kind of recognition of the fact that the MPS sector is becoming increasingly important. It's been growing at pace. So figures from consultancy Next Wealth show that it hit 123 billion at the end of March in discretionary MPS portfolios. That is up from 71 billion in 2021. So it's a growing and kind of important sector of the financial advice landscape, but there hasn't really been the data to allow for performance comparisons between the different providers. It's just not been as easy to compare MPS performance. Not as easy as it is to do with funds. So we really just wanted to kind of shed a bit of light on MPS performance, because a lot gets written about MPS, but it doesn't tend to be about how they've returned. And we've been able to do that really due to the data that Morningstar is providing. So Morningstar launched its kind of MPS data coverage around a couple of years ago. It has a pretty good coverage of the market. For the purposes of this series, where we're looking at the 10 largest MPS providers, data for 8 of them came from Morningstar. And for the other two, which is FE and OpenWork, we requested the data directly from them.
I mean, if we take the best performers first, so I think Tatton and Quilter showed on average the best performance across all their portfolios. I mean, what did you find out about those DFMs? Why was that the case? Dan, let's start with you again.
Well, with Quilter, essentially, this is probably quite a simplistic way of looking at it, but it kind of boils down to sort of two key calls. One was being underweight risk in the run-up to the COVID crisis in 2020. And that, that wasn't because, Quilter somehow knew that there was going to be a global pandemic. It was just on the basis that equity valuations, they thought, were getting quite stretched. So as markets tanked in March 2020, they were running broadly a sort of lower equity exposure. And then they sort of rebalanced, moved more into equities at the right time, essentially towards the end of March, when markets started to recover. The other key call was being underweight fixed income bonds in 2022. 2022 was a bad year for bonds as inflation rose, and it was a particularly bad year for UK government debt, for gilts, as the I mean, you had this sort of difficult dynamic for the bond market anyway. And then you had the mini budget sort of crisis, where, you know, you had a lot of unfunded tax cuts being announced and that sort of spooking the gilt market. So being underweight that area of the market was extremely helpful to returns.
Definitely sounds like some, yes, good calls. Jeremy, you looked at Tatton, didn't you? So were there any similarities in that with Tatton?
Yes, some I would say. I mean, so Tatton runs 44 managed portfolios. At least there were 44 on our analysis, we should say. So yeah, there's a lot going on across all those different portfolios, which range from being wholly passive or largely passive to largely active. I mean, I'd say what stood out really in enabling Tatton to generate quite good performance was maintaining quite a high weighting to the US. That's probably something we'll come back to, but basically the US market has been the place to be, and lots of DFMs, whatever kinds of funds they're using, will use active asset allocation. Many thought, oh, the US looks quite fully valued, you might say, you know, and so lots of them would have been underweight, whereas Tatton, you know, basically maintained quite a high weighting to the US throughout, which has kind of helped boost their performance. Also, you know, they have made some good calls, for example, going a bit overweight Japan, when that was performing well. And also, yeah, there's always so much going on in these portfolios. I mean, even Tatton's managed portfolios, which is the name for their range using active funds, they do use a few kind of tracker funds in there, which probably have beaten active fund picks. I mean, on the bond side, for Tatton's kind of lower risk, lower equity portfolios, they were a bit weaker compared to the rest of the range. We're talking about kind of the average performance there versus kind of equivalent portfolios at other MPS providers. And Tatton basically ascribed that to the fact that those portfolios often run with quite a low equity weighting, they think, compared to lots of their peers. So yeah, I hope that gives some idea.
Yeah, definitely. But on average, the outperformance of the equity parts of the portfolio sort of outweighed that, would you say?
Exactly. I think sticking with those high weightings to US equities and, in a sense, kind of not making many mistakes was the kind of secret to Tatton's success. Maybe I can just add, it's curious. I mean, Tatton and Quilter, the best performing providers in our analysis, also the kind of two biggest. I think we're actually not totally sure, are we, Dan, which is bigger because they're so close, and it depends a bit how you splice it up. But funnily enough, Tatton sort of say they don't actually compete on performance. They want performance to be good. They want it to be solid. They don't want advisors to have issues with it. But funnily enough, it's things like service and, you know, knowledge of platforms and that kind of things, which they say are their edge rather than the strong returns.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. So what about the worst performers then? So I think when you looked at average performance, Parmenion and Brooks and LGT were among the worst performers there. Bit of a harsh question, but what did they do wrong? Jeremy, let's start with you again.
Sure. So that's particularly looking over 3 years, I think, that you're talking about there. I mean, maybe we can start with Brooks. Actually, when you look at 5-year kind of average performance across the MPS, Brooks comes out rather better. But I think particularly on the 3-year time frame, that there are a couple of factors which worked against Brooks. One is that they, within their ranges, they have a normal MPS, and then they have something called a volatility managed portfolio service, which kind of tracks to dynamic planners' risk boundaries. And what that means in a way is that they, both of those ranges mostly use active funds. And so they kind of have these two active focused ranges within their whole offering. And basically, yeah, due to this kind of problem we mentioned with the biggest US companies performing so strongly, that's been a problem for lots of active managers or people who try to pick active managers. So they kind of suffered because of that, really. That's the simplest thing. That's the kind of simplest explanation we could give. And yeah, sorry to repeat myself, but in a way, it was a similar story at LGT. I mean, LGT's passive portfolios, as with Brooks' portfolios, actually performed well. You know, they were invested in lots of global and US and perhaps even technology trackers, and those performed well. But again, with LGT, they have a bit of a focus towards quality stocks. So, you know, that means they look for managers who pick kind of profitable and stable companies. And even those kind of companies also tended to lag the big tech giants. So, yeah, it keeps coming back to the same thing, basically.
Interesting. Okay. Any similarities there with Parmenion, Dan? I think you looked at Parmenion.
Yeah, well, the issue with Parmenion, and it does, Parmenion came bottom of our rankings of the top 10 providers over 1, 3, and 5 years. When I say that ranking is based on, so we looked at how each portfolio had performed versus the average for all portfolios in its Morningstar sector, and we basically compiled all those numbers for every single portfolio that a provider offered and took the average of that. So on that basis, Parmenion doesn't do as well as all the other nine over 1, 3, and 5 years. But there is quite a wide variety of performance between its ranges, and it's got 110 portfolios, but quite a long way, the biggest kind of offering of any of the providers that we've looked at. And you know, the passive portfolios have actually been doing pretty well. Where Parmenion suffers is down to its ethical portfolios, and we've seen that really for a lot of the providers that we looked at. Parmenion suffers particularly because it has so many ethical portfolios. 50 of those 110 have some sort of kind of ESG bent. So, that just kind of means just the basic kind of maths of it is it has so many ethical portfolios. Ethical portfolios have suffered generally. It sort of performs badly on that basis. Ethical portfolios have lagged, particularly over the past 3 years. They tend to have a growth bias. They tend to have a kind of smaller mid-cap bias. None of those things have been good biases to have in the markets that we've had over the past 3 years. And, they haven't captured, understandably, they haven't captured as much as the rally in kind of commodities and the oil price that we've had. I guess the other thing to mention about Parmenion is it does have, in its aggressive portfolios, it does have a higher weighting than most of its other rivals to emerging markets, which hasn't been kind of helpful to performance recently.
Okay, interesting. I'd like to touch briefly on Timeline. I think, as we all know, it's one of the fastest growing MPS providers. It sort of differentiates itself because it's known for its low cost and very simple approach. I'm pretty sure it only uses index and systematic funds, actually. But I'm curious to know, Dan, did Timeline's approach actually benefit its performance compared to its peers? And yeah, what did you think of its performance when you were sort of reviewing that?
I mean, it definitely performs well. So with Timeline, we don't have the 5-year data for Timeline. We've got the 1 and the 3-year data. Timeline performs better than any of the 10 biggest providers over 1 year, and it's third over 3 years behind Quilter and Tatton. So its basic philosophy of low cost passive investing has done well. I think what's interesting with Timeline is, going into this analysis, I think my impression of Timeline had been, it just offers low cost exposure to the market. And it does do that, but there are nuances to it. So it has the classic range and the tracker range. The tracker range on the equity side is much more of a pure passive approach. With the weightings to different funds being in line with the weightings of those countries or regions in the global market. The classic range is different, however. That has a tilt towards emerging market and sorry, a tilt towards the value investing style and small cap stocks. I think it's also worth looking at the bond portion of Timeline's portfolios because they don't adhere to this same kind of pure sort of passive allocation approach. So Timeline, as with quite a lot of providers, has a kind of like a home bias, basically, in its bond portfolio. It has more gilts, more UK corporate bonds than that kind of sector of the market accounts for, than the UK sort of weighting in the global bond market. And again, you know, there's differences between the classic and the tracker range in the bond sort of section of the portfolio, where the classic range, we found that the bond portion of the classic range had done better than the bond portion of the tracker range, particularly over the past 3 years. And that's basically because the classic range is running a lower duration bond position. And that, you know, those sorts of bonds that have less sensitivity to interest rate rises hadn't done as badly in the kind of bond market sell-off, particularly in 2022.
Yeah, I just wanted to jump in on one point about Timeline, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Dan. But yeah, one thing I found kind of interesting was, you know, lots of these kinds of passive-focused, low-cost approaches, I think they kind of come in the wake of Vanguard Life Strategy's success. And, you know, we'll probably remember how in 2022, the Vanguard Life Strategy funds with lower equities, more bond exposure, they got hit really hard. And they actually don't limit duration at all, whereas all the Timeline portfolios kind of take some steps to limit duration, I think, Dan. And so, yeah, that is a kind of interesting difference that I found.
Well, the different approaches to duration are definitely reflected in the performance figures. So it's interesting if you compare the classic and the tracker ranges, and these kind of comparisons are easier to do with a provider like Timeline, where you have 10 portfolios and they differ in that they will run from a portfolio at the lowest risk end that there's all bonds, and then each kind of portfolio up the scale takes 10% more in equities, and where you look at how the tracker range as a whole has performed versus the classic range, you see that with classic, there's more kind of moderation in terms of performance because the bond portfolio sort of did better because of that lower duration position. You know, the losses aren't as severe at the low risk level end of the spectrum, but equally they haven't gained as much at the high risk end of the spectrum because of that kind of small cap and value tilt sort of dampening down returns. Whereas on the tracker range, the high equity portfolios have done really well, but the high bond low equity portfolios haven't done as well because of that that a higher duration bond position really kind of coming unstuck in the 2022 bond market crisis, and it's worth making the point that's something that we did see across quite a few providers. Where if you're looking at 3-year returns, actually the portfolios that have done badly, that have registered the highest losses, are the lowest risk portfolios, and it's down to gilts and it's down to bonds, and that I guess quite exceptional period in the market in 2022. I mean, you had one provider, SE, that has a similar kind of high weighting to gilts. They described it as a 1 in 20 years event, and so that's why you're seeing this, I guess, kind of counterintuitive sort of picture of performance, where the less risk you took on, the worse you did.
On gilts, Dan, it seemed to be something that came up in your analysis a lot. First of all, how many of the portfolios? Did a lot of the portfolios tend to have a home bias when it came to their fixed income allocation? And overall, would you say that helped or hindered performance?
Well, it definitely hindered performance. The providers that had a particularly kind of high exposure to gilts would be FE, Timeline, and Omnis. And yeah, there are decent reasons for it. These are portfolios for predominantly for UK financial advisors selling to UK clients. And those UK clients, yeah, their spending requirements are tied to UK inflation. So, you know, in that sense, it makes sense for there to be a home market bias within that conservative part of the portfolio, the bond side of it. We are the period over which we were looking. So we're looking at 1, 3, and 5 years to the end of August. That does include a particularly extreme market in 2020 to 2022 for fixed income. In that sense, if you're looking at portfolios that haven't done well because of this gilts exposure, those losses are real, but does it mean that those portfolios are set up wrong for the future? Maybe not, because you wouldn't expect to see the same kind of performance in the bond market that we had in 2022. So certainly not every year or every 3 years. We are looking at a particularly extreme time for the market.
Yeah. Okay. Jeremy, what about benchmarks? Something I noticed in your research is that you compared performance to sort of a couple of different sectors, market sectors and benchmarks, showing how different DFMs could potentially, their performance could potentially look better or worse based on what you compared it to. Is that the impression you had during this research, that perhaps DFMs were using certain sectors, benchmarks to cast their performance in a certain light?
I'm going to initially swerve the question, but then promise to try and come back to answer it. Yeah, so I suppose, benchmarks, it's a thorny issue. And that's why, Dan, when he did the analysis, he focused primarily on the Morningstar sectors, where, they're based on the returns of, I think nearly 1,300 portfolios in our analysis. For the biggest providers, I can't remember which they were instantly, where their data wasn't on Morningstar, we got it off them. And so that gave a very rigorous data set, really, to make these like-for-like comparisons between, equivalently risky portfolios, and then ask, on average, how are DFM's portfolios performing against equivalently risky peers? Now, we did also look, we thought it was fair to look at firms' own benchmarks. These are the benchmarks that they themselves are selecting for each of their portfolios. I think something that I came to realize I maybe hadn't quite thought about properly before is that for MPS or for other multi-asset portfolios at funds, there's a lot of leeway, really, you have in picking your own benchmark. And people can think about it quite differently. For example, lots of people still use kind of IA sector averages. So, for example, the sector average for, the IA mixed investment 40 to 85% shares sector. And in some cases, people are, a bit unhappy if you try and compare them to something else. But, of course, in that sector, there's a huge amount of variance. Another example might be the IA flexible sector, where, in fact, I'm not even going to really try and explain what it is, but basically it's been quite a good thing to be compared against because it contains a huge range of portfolios with all sorts of different equity weightings. And so if you're running a kind of flexible portfolio, model portfolio with a high equity weighting, it's quite an easy comparison. Generally, I think people were happy with our methodology. And I suppose the other point that they made was that advisors often use their own benchmarks. They have their own benchmarks for performance. And so in a sense, just saying, we've beaten our own benchmark that we've selected, whether it's ARC or whatever else, maybe it doesn't have quite the same weight as, say, like a UK equity fund beating the FTSE All Share. It's a bit more of a complicated picture. That probably doesn't quite answer your question.
No, it's I mean, there's a lot for advisors to scrutinize potentially, and perhaps yeah, they should pay closer attention to what portfolios are compared to. Guys, it's been so interesting to have you on and hear more about the research. I want to end the podcast with a quick fire question, and caveating this by saying I'm of course not asking you to predict future investment performance and where it comes from, but if you did the same research, let's say in 5 years' time, what qualities do you think some of the best performing DFMs might have?
I mean,
who wants to start?
Whether they'll, I can start that. Whether they would be the best performing, I'm not sure. But I think what we will definitely see if we repeat this exercise in 5 years is a greater move to passives. I think the dynamics in the MPS sector are exactly the same as we have in the funds industry, where there's just a move to lower costs. And I think that will be helped by the pronounced outperformance of passive strategies versus active, particularly over the last 3 years. I think that's just going to exacerbate a trend that was already there. So the kind of the timeline and to some extent to the Tatton with it passive MPSs, that kind of approach is just going to become more and more the norm. There'll be further driving down of costs.
I'll attempt to answer. I mean, for me, I think one of the things that emerged from the research was, in a way, the kind of predictability of passive performance. I mean, I think if you have a portfolio where the equity portion is largely passive, you're probably not going to be shocked in 5 years' time about what the result is. You're not going to say, you're not going to say I've hugely underperformed the global market. There's something predictable about it. I do think, and this is what, almost every DFM who runs active portfolios says, maybe the odds for those either picking active funds, particularly outside the US, or even timeline in their classic portfolios, tilting, away from pure market exposure towards small cap and value, you'd think the odds would be a bit better for some of that non-US mega cap tech exposure to deliver stronger performance. But I really don't know. I mean, we could have the same thing happening again, basically. As for the non-equity side, as Dan said, I think the effect of, in particular, the kind of gilt market crash in 2022 was very extreme and has had a very kind of extreme impact on the returns of lower risk portfolios across our analysis, how exposed they were to that. I mean, at a personal level, I find it hard to, I think the evidence about what you should be doing in that non-equity portfolio is hard to summarize in a way. And it's kind of hard to understand because it depends on bond markets and, things like whether absolute return funds actually have a place in portfolios or not. There's a lot of conflicting factors still in my mind.
Jeremy, Dan, thank you so much again for joining us. And for anyone who wants to read the analysis that Dan and Jeremy put together, we will link all of those in the show notes. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening.
From jet engines to space rockets, telephones to computers, the world has seen spectacular change in the last 100 years, and the pace of progress is getting faster and faster. From electric cars to the metaverse, drone deliveries to climate solutions and genetic sequencing, we're investing in the companies that are not just changing the world today, but are also shaping the future. The Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Invest in progress. Capital at risk.